From NPR News in New York, this is the Bryant Park Project with Allison Stewart and Luke Burbank.
You are listening to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. We're very happy you are, by the way. This is your home for news, information, and today, a little memorial for analog TV. I'm Allison Stewart.
And I'm Luke Burbank. It is Friday, October 19th. Allie, we made the possibly questionable decision to schedule a rock and roll band in here for later on in the hour. 8:30 a.m. might be a little early for someone who's been playing at CMJ. It's this big music fest that's happening in New York, so we'll see how that goes.
All right, fingers crossed, sons and daughters will show up.
Yes?
Okay, coming up on the show, what we mentioned about digital TV. Well, I don't know if you know this or not, but all of our TVs are going from analog to digital. Confused what it means for your life? Don't really care? Well, we'll bring in someone who will try to make you care.
And something that is not hard to care about, breast cancer. There's a new test out which could actually tell somebody if they're more likely to get cancer because of a genetic mutation. Question is, would you take that test? Would you actually want to know? I actually spoke with a woman who did, and we'll find out what that effect that had on her life.
It is also dry as a bone in the Southeast. The worst drought conditions in over 100 years. We'll get the details from officials in North Carolina. We'll also get today's headlines from Rachel Martin in just a minute. But first, here's the BPP's big story. Former Pakistani Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto narrowly escaped death yesterday when two bombs exploded near her convoy in the city of Karachi. At least 136 people were killed, according to authorities.
Reports of the number of wounded vary from 250 to 400. Bhutto herself was not injured. The attack happened just hours after she returned to the country after 8 years in self-imposed exile.
She was making her way on a parade route through Karachi, lined by hundreds of thousands of cheering supporters.
Pakistani President General Pervez Musharraf, who is attempting to form a pro-U.S. anti-militant coalition with Bhutto. He labeled the attack part of a, quote, conspiracy against democracy.
And joining us now from Karachi to give us the latest on the bombing is Kamal Siddiqui, editor of the News International, one of Pakistan's largest English language newspapers. Kamal, what is the latest information you have on the bombings?
Well, the latest information we have is that the local security officials have said that it is a suicide bombing, but they have not yet been able to identify who is behind it. And at the same time, the death toll has climbed to around 140 now.
Can you describe the nature of the relationship between Pakistan's President Pervez Musharraf and Benazir Bhutto at this point? And what impact do you think this bombing will have on that relationship?
I think it will bring them closer because both of them have been targeted by religious extremists. In that sense, this bombing has brought home the threat of religious extremism to both of them. At the same time, possibly it's a love-hate relationship because General Musharraf is a military dictator and Benazir Bhutto is a popularly elected leader. But I think at this point they will come closer and try to cobble together some sort of power-sharing arrangement which will allow them to keep the extremists at bay.
It was a kind of remarkable coincidence that she got into the armored vehicle just before this bomb went off. She had been sort of exposed before that. Kamal Siddiqui, editor of the News International, one of Pakistan's largest English, that's catching, Allison, English language newspapers. Thank you, Kamal.
Thank you very much.
That is today's BPP Big Story. Now, let's get the rest of the news with Rachel Martin.
This is NPR.
Hey, everyone. Good morning. After pledging to overturn a presidential veto, when it came down to it, Democratic lawmakers just didn't have the votes. Yesterday, the House upheld President Bush's veto of a bill to broaden the S-CHIP. That's the state children's health insurance program. Dems have been pushing the bill as a way to give health insurance to kids from families that make too much money to qualify for Medicaid, but not enough to afford private insurance. Democrats waged a multi-multi-million-dollar ad campaign and lobbied hard for the bill, but it still came up 13 votes short of the two-thirds needed to pass. Democrats say they'll make some minor changes and send it back to the president's desk next month. And the questions were tougher and more direct yesterday at confirmation hearings for the U.S. Attorney General nominee Michael Mukasey. It was day two of the hearings, and the Senate Judicial Committee asked some direct questions to determine how far Mukasey would distance himself from the White House when it comes to national security issues. Mukasey suggested that the Bush administration's warrantless domestic surveillance program could be constitutional, which then riled some Democratic lawmakers. The tone of the hearings intensified when Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island asked Mukasey whether waterboarding, an interrogation technique that simulates drowning, is constitutional, to which Mukasey responded,
"I don't know what's involved in the technique. If waterboarding is torture, torture is not constitutional."
If waterboarding is constitutional is a massive hedge.
Still, the retired New York judge is considered likely to be confirmed by the Senate, although a final vote could be delayed until Mukasey gives written answers to some questions posed by the committee. Severe storms are ravaging much of the country this week. High winds approaching tornado intensity struck northeastern Missouri yesterday, killing two people in a mobile home, according to authorities. High winds in the area downed trees, power lines, and utility poles. Two tornadoes also touched down in the southwest part of the state. In the St. Louis area, nearly 10,000 customers were without power from wind, lightning strikes, and downed trees. The storms also did damage in Illinois and parts of Oklahoma. And let's move across the pond, where the BBC is making its own news. Britain's public broadcaster, the BBC, or Anti-Beeb as it's fondly known, is cutting some jobs, 1,800 jobs to be exact. The cuts are part of the BBC's plan to integrate its TV, radio, and internet news operations. News departments will be the hardest hit. The announcement is the second major job cut in 2 years. 4,000 jobs were eliminated in 2005. Staff of the Beeb say morale is low and unions have threatened to strike. Finally today, it's been a tough week for French President Nicolas Sarkozy. Today is the second day in a two-day transit strike that has paralyzed much of the country. Union workers walked off the job in response to a move by Sarkozy to trim worker protections in order to stimulate the country's economy. Union leaders resumed partial service today, but were urging people to walk or ride bikes to get around. But it's just the beginning of Sarkozy's woes. The strike coincided with an announcement this week that the French president and his wife of 11 years are calling it quits. The president's office confirmed the rumors that have been circulating for months in France. It makes Sarkozy the first French president to get divorced while in office, which does not exactly a scandal make in France, considering one French president died in the bed of his mistress in 1899, and a little more recently, former President François Mitterrand fathered a daughter with his mistress. Scandalous. That's the news. It's always online at npr.org.
This is NPR.
Luke and Allison.
You know, I read a quote from Sarkozy when he and his wife had kind of reunited a little while ago. They had been apart and they got back together. And he said, "We're definitely going to stay together. I'm 100%. I read that. I was like kind of sad. I mean, this guy is the leader of France.
C'est la vie, man.
I guess so. I guess he was optimistic at one point.
Oh, boy. Okay, Rachel, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Hey, it's dry, really, really dry, as in drought conditions in Georgia, Alabama, Tennessee, and North Carolina. According to reports, Hotlanta now has just about 87 days of drinking water left. If there isn't any rain anytime soon, Raleigh, North Carolina, about 97 days. It has been classified as an extreme drought. The first time in 100 years these states have been in such a bad way. Some municipalities are 60 days from running out of water. Severe restrictions are in place. For instance, in Georgia, water normally provided to protect endangered species has been redirected until they can find out if they have enough water for the residents. So how long can this go on? Let's check in with someone from one of the hard-hit states, North Carolina. Ryan Boyles is the director of the North Carolina's Climate Office. Hi, Ryan.
Good morning.
Can you give us a little bit of perspective? If you're an average resident in North Carolina, how is this affecting your daily life?
Well, about 50% of the state's population now is under mandatory restrictions, different severities. But chances are you probably are strongly discouraged from using any outdoor water. You still have enough water for basic health and sanitation purposes, but they're really trying to limit outdoor water use and any non-essential water usage across most of the state.
If you get caught using water the wrong way, is there any punishment at this point?
There are warnings initially in most cities and towns, and then usually some fines, some of them pretty hefty, hundreds to even thousands of dollars.
Can you put this in perspective a little bit? I feel like we always hear about droughts in various parts of the country. Is this a particularly bad one?
Yeah, droughts are challenging to compare with each other because they affect different parts of the state or the region on different timescales. You know, sometimes it's only last a few months. Sometimes it can last years. For instance, this year we've had very severe, very short-term drought conditions, really almost no rain since about June, May-June time frame. Most of the state has had less than half of its normal water. Some parts of the state here in North Carolina and across the southeast are, you know, only a quarter of the water that they would normally expect to see.
So is this as simple as lack of rainfall, or is this a result of not being judicious about water use?
Well, we're generally pretty wet down here, and the, ultimately what starts the drought is a lack of rainfall. And certainly the fact that there's a growing population across the South, their increasing demands on what are fairly limited water supplies can exacerbate it. But it's the lack of rainfall that starts the drought, and it's going to be rainfall that ultimately ends the drought.
Short term, people, residents in this area can't take a 30-minute shower. But long term, what are some of the consequences of this drought for the economic health of the area?
Well, it's twofolded, really. In some cases, it'll really spur development and spur some of the local planning boards to look at longer-term water policy and how to either establish better conservation over the long term or identify new water resources. That's certainly something that a lot of towns are looking at so they can continue to see the sustained growth that they'd like to. In some cases, in terms of some businesses and agriculture, it really is just a short-term issue, and it'll be over as soon as the rains come and we see our reservoirs and our groundwater supplies replenish.
Here's something that I don't exactly understand about droughts. You know, they say that places are 60 days from running out of water. I mean, I've never been anywhere, even in the worst drought, where you turn the faucet on and water doesn't come out. I mean, what is the absolute worst it could get? Literally, could there be no water flowing through the pipes in places?
That's pretty unlikely to happen. We haven't gone 60 days with no rainfall, I don't think, ever in the southeast. It's very unusual to go that far. And we have a few occurrences where they go 30, 40 days in some of the worst situations. But even then, what that means is that they might have to, you know, tackle in water from another location. They might have to build an emergency interconnect with a nearby town. But it's pretty unlikely that the water is actually not going to flow.
So if there's always a possibility to bring in water from somewhere, and if droughts are something that are fairly cyclical and that seem to happen in various places all the time, isn't this just part of life? I mean, should we even call it a drought, or should it just be the weather?
Well, you know, that's a good point, and we make a specific distinction between dry weather and drought. Dry weather is when you just haven't had any rainfall and you start to, you know, maybe think about it. But it becomes drought when you see impacts, to agriculture, impacts to water supplies, to utilities. Then it becomes drought, and we've been monitoring those impacts, and that's largely the way in which we depict severity. When the impacts get to be exceptional conditions like we're seeing now, that's when sometimes you start to see a little more action, a little more attention from not only the general public, but also from the elected and bureaucratic folks who have responsibilities to take action.
We're talking to Ryan Bowles, the director of the State Climate Office of North Carolina. So, Ryan, you use words like exceptional and extreme. What's the timetable on this? When does this become urgent?
Well, for some communities, I think it's urgent already and has been urgent. There are several examples of communities that are really trying to scramble and make sure that they don't have to run the taps dry. There are dramatic cuts. A couple towns have asked for a 50% reduction in their water usage overall. And that impacts not only everyday Joe, but also a lot of the industrial users down here. But in terms of what we expect to see over the short term and where we're going, we're going to see rain eventually. We'll start to see some recharge. Our concern right now is really whether we're going to get the kind of rainfall we need this winter to recharge everything. And if not, we may be in the same boat again next year.
Now, the governor is threatening to declare a state of emergency if citizens don't heed the restrictions that are currently in place. What's the next step?
I think we're going to see, and we have already started to see, widespread response, and folks are conserving. Ultimately, we're really waiting on the rain, and it'll come eventually, I promise. The drought will end.
Wow, you're on the record promising the rain will come.
It's an easy forecast to make for someone like me. It will rain eventually down here.
Maybe he's got an in.
Really need to get through the short-term emergency, but then also make plans and think about what we need to do for the longer term, the next 12 months as well. And what it may mean is that if we don't see the recharge we need this winter, we may see mandatory water restrictions throughout all of next summer.
Ryan Boyles is the director of the State Climate Office of North Carolina. Good luck to you folks down there.
Thank you.
Allie, I was out with our video producer, Wynn Rosenfeld, having a drink at this cool bar called Welcome to the Johnsons. It's set up
Welcome to the Johnsons.
A rec room.
And what I Lowyside.
That's right. And what I noticed was that they had this old TV in there, like the kind you had when you, you know, were a kid. And, you know, it had the actual knob you turn. And I thought, how quaint. But actually, I was doing research for the show because it turns out there's big news in the world of digital versus analog TV. That's an analog TV I was looking at, and we're going to find out if people should care about that or not.
Well, good luck putting that Pabst Blue Ribbon on the expense account. I'm not sure they're going to pay for that.
I just put it down as beverage.
Also coming up, we have the most. We take you through the most viewed, most emailed. We found out there's one called Most Printed. Stories on the web. Our producers will join us in just a moment. You're watching the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.
On digital, always digital.
Now it's the time we get all democratic on you. It's not the best or the brightest. It's the most. This one run down the most emailed, most read, and most blogged stories on the web, and we bring in the BPP crew to tell us what they found. Hi, Dan.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Dan Pashman, producer extraordinaire, also Ilya Meritz. Matt in the control room, not putting the clock up, but soon doing it.
Hello.
Oh, and Trish McKinney. Hi, guys.
Hey. Well, we get most emailed on Yahoo News, guys. Couple make burglar clean up at gunpoint. This is Montgomery, Alabama. Burglar breaks into the house. Couple comes home from being away for a week. They see their whole house is messed up. As they're going through the house, they find the burglar still in the house. Well, the husband owned a firearm, pulled out his gun, and held the burglar at gunpoint and made him clean up that mess. And then waited for the cops.
I love that story.
That would be the worst part about, I think, getting robbed. Or let's just say this, a thing you wouldn't think about. First, they take your stuff. It's very, you feel very violated. And there's a mess.
Yeah. And then the burglar actually complained to the police about being forced to clean the apartment.
That's called chutzpah.
All right, Ilya Meritz, you've got something for us.
Yeah, this is from USA Today. It's the number one most emailed. It's a major investigation. Military inadvertently recruits gays. The Army, Navy, and Air Force unwittingly advertise for recruits on a website for gays. It's called Glee. It appears to be a social networking site. I've had a look at it. Doesn't look like a hookup site. Major Michael Baptista, advertising branch chief for the Army National Guard, said we didn't knowingly advertise on that particular website, which he said does not meet the moral standards of the military. So they pulled the ads from this gay social networking site. They're boo-boo.
Don't ask, don't email.
Don't advertise.
Yeah, right.
Stay away.
Let's go to the control room.
Hello,
control room.
Hello.
How's NPR doing in the land of the most emailed?
Well, in the land of the most emailed, it's a story by the Kitchen Sisters. They've been doing this Hidden Kitchen series, and it was the birth of the Frito that shot to the top of the most emailed at npr.org. and it aired on Morning Edition tomorrow. And it's all about how the Frito came to be. And it was invented by, actually, it wasn't invented by Charles Elmer Doolin. He basically ripped it off from the Mexicans and turned it into his own little thing. Here's Kalita Doolin, the daughter of the inventor of Fritos, talking about what made her father such a good food innovator.
Part of the secret ingredients of Frito is that it's his own corn. There were experimental farms where he was hybridizing his own corn and trying to discover ways to use the byproducts. He and his brother invented a lot of the machinery, did all of the conveyor belts, like, you know, Ford automobiles, the mechanization of snack food.
It's just like Ford, man.
I want you to know I did invent the burrito. A lot of people think that was Mexico. That was me.
Okay.
That was me. You know, the third thing about these Kitchen Sisters stories is that you don't get up in the morning thinking, I wonder what the story behind Fritos is, but you start listening and...
You're hooked.
You are hooked.
Yeah. Like Fritos.
That's
start
right.
Start with one.
Like Fritos.
Can't stop.
All right, Trish McKinney, you've got something for us.
Yeah, I have the most emailed story in the Albuquerque Journal, and it has a great tie to the baseball playoffs. Apparently, the Boston Red Sox, one of the players on their team, is the first Navajo in Major League Baseball. His name is Jacob Ellsbury. He is he's not a star player, and in fact, the article says he doesn't even have a baseball card yet. He's a substitute player. But he's done some duty in about 33 games and batted .353, which, I don't know, sounds pretty good to me.
That's good. That's good.
He's not from New Mexico, but he has ties to the Navajo Nation in New Mexico. His family lived there. He spent summers there because his mother, a full-blooded Navajo woman, told him never to forget his heritage. So apparently he's bringing baseball to the reservation. People are much more excited about it than they've ever been. And, you know, apparently the big sports prior to this were basketball and rodeo.
Oh, and what paper was that from?
The Albuquerque Journal.
Ironically, his team is playing the Cleveland Indians.
Hmm. Oh, yeah, I buried that lead. That was actually my favorite part of the story, is he has to play the Indians.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, that. Hey, so I don't know if you guys have seen this movie. I've been talking about it. Lars and the Real Girl. It stars Ryan Gosling, Academy Award nominee, and it's about this guy in a sort of northwestern, seems to be Minnesota.
Midwestern.
Yeah, Midwestern, North Midwest, you know, Minnesota, North Wisconsin area, where he basically falls in love with this doll that he buys, this life-size, anatomically correct doll, because he's got a little bit of an emotional deficiency. And the most emailed story on Yahoo, one of them, is about these dolls. They're called real dolls. They can be upwards of $6,500. They can weigh as much as a real woman. They are anatomically correct. But some people use them, you know, it sounds like a dirty joke, these dolls, but that some people really use them as companions. And it's not just a kind of a sleazy thing anymore.
Yeah, I saw an HBO special on the creation of one of these dolls, and it's like watching an artist go to work. That each one is handmade, and
yeah.
They paint. You know, their eyeballs are painted carefully.
Look, if people can get attached to Roomba vacuums, I can understand why they might get attached to a real life-size doll.
Maybe next week we can get somebody on from that company and find out a little bit more about that.
I went on the website. Please don't call me, NPR tech support. I just was checking it out.
We won't be linking to that website.
No, we really won't, because people use them for other things besides company. Hey, that's it for the most. Thanks, everybody.
October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Here's a question. If you could find out if you had a gene that could actually cause an increased chance of breast cancer, would you actually want to find out? Would you take that test? Well, thanks to an amazing advance in genetics, one company is now offering such a test to women, a chance to find out if they have one of two genes that may predispose them for breast or uterine cancer. They're called BRCA1 and 2, and it's the first test of its kind that's being marketed to the general public. Well, a while ago, I spoke with a woman named Connie Elliott. She's a Salt Lake City real estate broker. Her sister suffered from fallopian tube cancer, also caused by that gene, and she decided to take the test and found out that she, too, had this cancer-linked gene. We also talked to Art Kaplan. He's a doctor. He's a bioethicist at the University of Pennsylvania, and he spends a lot of time thinking about the ramifications of offering people this test. So anyway, here's Connie Elliott telling me about how she found out that she had this gene, which is linked to higher rates of cancer.
I was actually sitting in my office with my husband, and when the counselor called, and I opted to have the results given to me over the phone. You can go into the office or you can have it over the phone.
So you were at work.
I was at work, yeah. And at first I was kind of going into it as I really felt, you know, I'm not going to have the mutation. I'm going to be fine. And then when they tell you, it's kind of a shock factor because reality really sets in.
What went through your mind when you heard the news?
Just kind of a sinky feeling, you know, thinking, oh my gosh, you know, I do not want to face the fate that my sister has.
Yeah.
So at first it's shock, and then it's like, well, you know what? I can fix this.
Well, that's kind of why we wanted to talk to you as well, because you took some very proactive steps. What did you do in the aftermath of getting this result?
Well, the first step that I took was to have a total hysterectomy, and that was done within a couple of months of finding out. And a lot of that, I mean, it's different for each woman. A lot of it is, you know, based on my personal decisions on children, where I was at, and my age. And so I had chosen, and even by the encouragement of my sister who's going through this, she's like, have it done sooner than later because, you know, she had gone through all of her yearly routines and everything. And within 3 months of having that, she was diagnosed with stage 4.
Wow.
So it's so hard to detect that's one of the things they say, you know, let's go in and just take care of this and reduce your risk.
And I understand that you're also scheduled to have a double mastectomy?
Yes.
So your entire, you know, body has been radically changed by this information that you have this genetic mutation. Do you ever wonder if you're overreacting?
No. I mean, I take a stance that, you know, if I can protect myself or if I can make something better with the information and things that I have at my disposal, I'm going to do it. I'm going to take advantage of what's there for me. And it's totally a personal decision. I'm not one that's attached to any particular part of my body. And I did the research, and I saw the reconstruction that can be done and, you know, have spoken to the doctors and you know, my decision. I felt comfortable that when I'm done with this, I'll be fine.
Well, let's bring somebody else into the conversation now, Connie. We've got Dr. Arthur Kaplan on the line. He's chair of the Department of Medical Ethics at the University of Pennsylvania. Hi, Dr. Kaplan.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Well, obviously, this test gave this woman, Connie Elliott, some really useful information, but she's in a very small minority of women who actually would potentially have this. Does that give you reason for concern about the kind of wide approach they're taking with advertising this genetic test?
It does. Connie's case is one in which she's got a hereditary form of cancer, ovarian showed up, could be breast. That accounts for about 10% of breast cancer. Maybe 1 in 400 women will have the mutation that she and her sister had. If you smoke or have a high-fat diet or exposed to certain chemicals, that's the overwhelming majority of breast cancer cases not associated with this mutation. So the company is advertising broadly to all women. Their rationale is, well, we'll still pick up some women like Connie who don't know they have this in their family. But I worry about that because I think a lot of women are going to be frightened who don't have this family history of immediate genetic relatives with ovarian or fallopian or breast cancer. They don't need to come in and get this test. It doesn't make sense to spend the $3,000 that way.
Well, I mean, though, let's just say that it's covered by insurance or somebody has the resources. I mean, if 100 women find out that they have this, isn't that worth something?
It is worth something, although I think you'd spend the money in a better way if you kept going after high-fat diet reduction, lifestyle change, more breast cancer exams, even stopping smoking campaigns, because those are the bulk of the causes, not the genes.
You think it's sort of needle in a haystack insurance?
There is a little bit of needle in the haystack going on. I worry that, you know, people are going to focus in on the BRCA1 and 2 forms of cancer, and they're important. I don't mean to say not important, but the overwhelming number of women who get breast cancer are not going to get it for these reasons. They're going to get it later in life for lifestyle choices or other genes that we can't figure out yet. So it is a kind of applying a gigantic shotgun when a rifle would make more sense in terms of advertising. What you want to do is say, if you've got immediate relatives who've had breast or ovarian cancer, think about this test.
Dr. Kaplan, as the sort of we continue to map the genome, though, I mean, we're going to have more and more of these kinds of tests for different kinds of things. Is that going to be a good thing?
I think it's going to be a good thing. I'm all for more genetic knowledge, but it has a downside. If you go in for this test, some companies are going to say, you know what, for your life insurance or your health insurance, if you're getting tested for a particular costly, risky disease, maybe we don't want to insure you. I know of companies that have said just getting the test, not even with a positive result, that's enough to scare them into saying we're not going to write life insurance. So we don't have right now good protection of genetic privacy. And technically, when you find a genetic disease, whether it's this one or other ones coming down the road, tests for diabetes or depression, whatever, those are pre-existing conditions. And as I think many listeners know, those will void your health or life insurance policies if you know you've got them and you don't disclose them. So we got a lot of infrastructure, ethical and legal, to build if we're going to take advantage of the genetic revolution.
I mean, Dr. Kaplan, would you tell women in your family to get this test if, say, the money wasn't an object?
I'd say get the test if there's a family history. I'd say get it by paying out of pocket. I'd say don't try to charge your insurance company because that may be the end of your insurance.
Connie Elliott of Salt Lake City, you got to probably feel like this test saved your life.
Yeah, I do in a sense that, you know, my risk was increased by so much, and I wasn't willing to gamble by, you know, I mean, there's a risk, you know, a chance that I could not, you know, I wouldn't get cancer. I don't have cancer right now, but I'm not willing to take that risk of down the line finding out that I could have taken care of it now and then faced reality.
That's Connie Elliott, a Salt Lake City real estate broker. She had her genes tested for a predisposition to certain cancers. We also heard from Art Kaplan of the University of Pennsylvania. We got a statement from Myriad Genetics, the maker of the test. Here's what they told us. Myriad Genetics has initiated the BRCA Analysis Awareness Campaign to improve awareness of the potentially life-saving information provided by its genetic test. We encourage women with a strong family history through the use of a positive, responsible message to become empowered by visiting their healthcare provider to determine whether they are appropriate candidates for testing.
Okay, so today in Washington, D.C., it's the kickoff of that Values Voter Summit. We talked about it yesterday. It's sponsored by the conservative group Family Research Council. They're the ones that call it the Values Voter Summit. 2,000 conservative Christians are expected to gather this weekend to talk about religious freedom, marriage, immigration, national security. Well, yesterday we talked to two people who were going to the conference from different parts of the United States. It was Mike was from Maine and Kathy was from Arizona. And we asked them about, what about people who hold different beliefs than they do? And they say, hey, we have values too. And we open that up to you on our blog, this question. Do you consider yourself a values voter? And what does that actually even mean?
Well, somebody named Suzanne Wargo sort of put her name in the list. She said, I'm a very liberal values voter. I'm devoted to my job and my community. I serve on a local town board and regularly volunteer my time with scouting. I live my family values by demonstrating them. I don't cram my values verbally towards others to make them think I'm holier than they are. I'm tolerant of others and believe firmly in the greater value of human rights for all, even when it's not politically correct or convenient. My guess with this philosophy, I would not be welcome at the Family Research Tour.
Arthur Kellogg also posted on our website. Hi, Arthur, if you're listening. I believe in less government. I do not believe it is the business of the federal government to tell individuals what they can do with their bodies, time, or money. I do not believe in abortion nor same-sex marriage. However, it is not my right to tell someone how to live their life.
This from a guy named, or a person named Ray Whitlock. I'm not sure if it's a guy or a girl.
I think it's
Ray.
It's R-A-E, so I think Ray's
a chick.
That
means girl Ray?
Yeah.
Okay. Girl Ray Whitlock says, even though conservative, in quotes, and evangelical, in quotes, are two words that a good number of people would use to describe me, I find the FRC's absconding of the word, quote, values really irritating, but predictable. Every voter invariably votes according to what he or she values, even if it's just a toothy grin and a winsome attitude. To say that values only consist of defeating Roe versus Wade and gay marriage, which was what's termed in the 90s as family values, is silly.
You can read these postings or post your own on our blog at bryantpark.org. This week, all the TVs in Whitehaven, Cumbria, UK went digital. Why is it worth note? Well, the small town is the first to make the switch from analog to digital signal, something the whole country will do by the year 2012. Here's the Guardian newspaper's John Plunkett, who went up to Whitehaven to watch TV with the locals.
I was watching BBC Two on analog. One minute it was snooker, next minute it was a black and white fuzzy screen. I felt a pang of anxiety, like you always do when your TV stops working, but I needn't have worried because 50 minutes later, ITV1 had switched over to the old BBC Two slot, and it was a rubbish phone-in competition quiz. So normal service was resumed.
Oh, it's going to happen here in the States, too, sooner than you think, by February of 09. Haven't you heard the PSAs?
Digital TVs got better picture, better sound, more channels. In fact, digital so much better that by law, all broadcast TV has to be digital by 2009. But there's a catch. Some TVs need an upgrade to get digital. You could even lose your signal.
All right, well, even if you aren't ready, businesses are gearing up. This week, Best Buy announced it won't even sell analog TVs anymore. Now, if you're yawning right now, turn up the volume. Sounds like it's time for another edition of Make Me Care, subject digital TV. Our guest is Shermaze Ingram. She's the Director of Media Relations for the National Association of Broadcasters Digital Television Transition Campaign. So just quickly, digital TV as opposed to analog TV, what's the difference?
The difference is that digital television is a much more efficient and much more flexible technology that allows television stations to provide clearer pictures, better sound quality, and more programming options for television viewers.
Okay, I can tell you are good at your job.
Shermaze, you work for digital TV. Is there someone for analog TV?
Somebody out there with the rabbit ears? All right, we're putting 60 seconds on our Make Me Care clock. Here's the scoop. You have 1 minute to engage us on this subject. Now, when you hear the ticking, you have just 10 seconds left. So, Shermaze, digital TV switchover, Make Me Care.
Millions of people across the country are at risk of losing their television signals on February 17, 2009, if they don't take the necessary steps to receive a digital signal.
Wow, that was it.
That was it? That's why I should care?
That's why you should care. That was the shortest amount of time
anyone's ever used for the Make
Bottom
Me Care
line,
segment.
I can't watch TV anymore. That's why I should care.
Bottom line is that nearly 20 million American households rely exclusively on free over-the-air television, and those are the households that are at most risk of losing their television signal, and we want to make sure we get that message out to those households and let them know that come January of next year, the government will be providing free coupons worth $40 each, and each household is eligible for two of those coupons that can be used toward the purchase of a digital-to-analog converter box that they can use with their existing analog television. So there is help out there, and we want to make sure people are aware of that.
All right, Shermaze, you made me care if I can't watch TV.
I guess, although I am a little fond of my television that has the broken
little
turner
handle.
Knob. I have pliers for it, but I guess it's going to have to go.
Shermaze Ingram from the Digital Television Transition Campaign. Thanks for making us care.
Thank you.
I was really glad we were able to throw in a little tape from the Beeb because our next guests, Scotsmen all, were smiling. They were so happy to hear someone from the aisles here in the big bad United States. They're called Sons and Daughters, and they are here for the CMJ Music Marathon. They're going to be playing for us live in studio when we come back.
Plus, we'll have all the headlines with our own Rachel Martin. This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.
You ready, ladies and gentlemen? Here I come.
We'll be right back.
Monday. Hey, the weekend is over. Time to get back into the swing of things.
But first, take Saturday and Sunday off. We'll be here following all the politics, music, sports.
I'm Allison Stewart.
And I'm Luke Burbank.
It's all right here at the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. Monday morning, it was all I hoped it would be.
Welcome back to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. We're always available online at npr.org/Bryant Park. I'm Luke Burbank.
And I'm Allison Stewart. Coming up, the Scottish band Sons and Daughters. They're here for a little morning rock music, and they look remarkably awake.
Yes.
I'm very impressed. First, let's hear about today's headlines from our own Rachel Martin.
This is NPR.
Hey, good morning, everyone. The search is over for a Canadian man accused of several counts of pedophilia. He was arrested today in northeastern Thailand after a massive international manhunt. The suspect is 32-year-old Christopher Paul Neal, a school teacher who'd been working in Thailand, South Korea, and Vietnam since 2000. Interpol has been looking for Neal since 2004, when German police discovered about 200 online photos of a man sexually abusing children. The man's face was digitally obscured, but police were able to clarify the image, and pictures of Neal were released and circulated last week. GOP voters could have one fewer choice in the upcoming presidential primaries after today. According to reports, Sam Brownback, the Republican senator from Kansas, is expected to announce he's dropping out of the presidential race. Brownback has had a hard time getting the kind of financial support necessary to rival top GOP contenders like Rudy Giuliani and Mitt Romney. Campaign aides say an announcement is expected today in Topeka. And it's the end of an era for the New York Yankees. Yankees manager Joe Torre is calling it quits. He led the Yankees from 1996 to 2007 and brought home four World Series championships in that time. But the Yankees didn't make it to the series this year. If they had, Torre would have been guaranteed $8 million for 2 years. Instead, the Yanks offered him five. It would have kept Torre as the highest paid manager in the majors, but it's still a pay cut. Spokesman for the Yankees says they're actively looking for Torre's replacement. The main criteria? Someone who can get the Yankees to the World Series next year. And there are a few people to remember today. Comedian and Brat Packer Joey Bishop passed away yesterday at his home, in California, at the age of 89. And actress Deborah Carr, famous for leading roles in From Here to Eternity and The King and I, has also died. She was 86. And another star of that golden era, whose name you may not know, but back in the 1950s, she was totally the bee's knees. Her name was Teresa Brewer. That was her back in the day singing her hit Ricochet. She topped the 1950s charts with hits like Ricochet and another song, Into Each Life, Some Rain Must Fall. She sang with greats like Tony Bennett, Duke Ellington, Dizzy Gillespie, and Wynton Marsalis. She died at her home just outside New York City. She was 76. That's the news. It's always online at npr.org.
This is NPR.
Luke Nelson, back to you.
A little song called Iodine from the Scottish band Sons and Daughters off their upcoming record. Sons and Daughters is, are. They're here in New York this week as part of CMJ Music Marathon. Along with South by Southwest down in Austin, CMJ is kind of the big showcase for lots of indie bands, a chance to impress music writers and fans with their awesomeness. And wonder of wonders, we actually got them to come in at this fine hour of the morning. Sons and Daughters is Adele Bethel, David Gao, Ailey Lennon, and Scott Patterson. Thank you very much for coming in on the Bryant Park Project.
Thanks for
welcome.
Us.
Yeah, yeah, it was this pretty rock star last night, you know, going to bed at 8 o'clock so you can come in for your radio interview.
Yeah.
You guys are from Glasgow, and I was doing a little crack research this morning, and I looked up a list of famous bands from Glasgow. And, like, I know about some of the famous, like, there's gum on the script from when I took that out.
Oh, that is fairly disgusting. Yeah. Look at you.
Why aren't we videotaping this? I mean, this is like, it's like Silly Putty spearmint style. Anyway, on my list, there are, like, kind of bands that, of course, people know about, Belle and Sebastian and Franz Ferdinand. But I didn't know Average White Band was from Scotland.
Yeah.
Big influence for you guys?
Oh, sure.
What do you think it is about Glasgow that has such a sort of musical vibe?
I have no idea. It's just, I mean, it's weird because it is such a small city, you know. It's, I mean, it's tiny. And for some reason, it's got a huge output of music, you know, comparatively in the UK. It's got, you know, almost the same amount as London, I'd say.
It went through kind of a resurgence because at one point Glasgow was sort of a down industrial city, right? And then it just sort of had this rebirth, the city itself.
Yeah. I mean, through the kind of 70s and 80s, it was kind of very down. And, you know, now it's kind of is going through a real kind of resurgence, like you say. And,
yeah,
you know,
like a lot of industries failed and, you know, like shipbuilding. But it's sort of...
It's slowly kind of bringing more tourists kind of back into the city. So the city's changed because of that, you know, a little bit in the same way that maybe New York's changed, you know, the last 10, 15 years. But it's not necessarily a bad thing for Glasgow.
Is it fun to be from a town where, you know, you guys are friends with Franz Ferdinand and lots of other acts, where there's this kind of dynamic energy and you're seeing your friends blow up with these big, you know, record deals?
Yeah, that was amazing to see that happen.
Yeah, I mean, it was just because the first tour we did with them, I think, was over here. And it was just, like, unbelievable watching them every night and people starting to go more crazy for them. Like, they were the, like, it was like your friends are the Beatles or something. It was really weird.
Because we knew they were great from the start. Yeah. It was the first time we saw them, we were like, man, they're going to be, you know, they're great, but I don't know if, you know, being from Glasgow, if people are going to like it. And then all of a sudden, you know, they're... You know, on MTV, and they're playing New York, and we're like, whoa.
Well, somebody wrote that if they're the Beatles, you guys are a scarier Rolling Stones.
That's
wow,
cool.
That's
I like
cute.
That.
Yeah. I was afraid to have you in after that description. Well, could you guys play a song for us?
Definitely.
Sure, yeah.
This is called this is going to be Split Lips?
Yes.
All right.
I'll try and keep it fast.
Sons and Daughters.
Accident.
Sons and Daughters.
Very nice.
Live and direct from Glasgow. A couple of ways you guys have been described in different reviews. I mentioned a scarier version of the Rolling Stone. You've also been called chilling, growling, bloody murder vocals. You guys seem so nice. How does that get started?
Well, the new record's very different.
Different house.
We're all in antidepressants.
We pushed out some issues on the last record.
You worked out your issues on the record?
Yeah, on the last one.
So that was the growling, bloody murder vocals? You guys in kind of a bad place emotionally when you made it?
Yeah.
You're not even joking.
I'm not joking.
With each other or just in your lives?
No, just in general.
Just in general?
This one's more sort of, I guess, sort of storytelling elements, more of that. It's sadder. There's a sort of, you know, it's not as angry.
You guys, speaking of a little melancholy, you guys toured with Morrissey?
We did. Mm.
Did you actually get to hang out with him?
Nobody hangs out with Morrissey.
I wouldn't say we hung out with him, but we certainly met him a couple of times and he was really nice.
He was amazingly cool, yeah.
Does he have his own giant bus that you're not ever allowed to go on?
Yep, he actually has his own bus that's just him. Yeah. And the rest of his band have a separate one.
But it's not, you know, it's not nasty or anything. It's really nice, just very shy.
He's very shy.
He's very friendly, though, when we met.
Was that a giant? I'm like the world's biggest Smiths fan, and I mean, did you guys grow up just loving on him? Was that such a thrill?
First record I ever fell in love with was Queen Is Dead, so.
Maybe want to play guitar.
It was a dream, really, for us to just share the stage with him, really.
We have about 5 minutes left, and I want to make sure we can get to another song. So if you guys aren't too tuckered out from playing the last one, do you guys think you could favor us with another tune?
Definitely.
This is going to be Chains?
This is, yeah.
All right.
This is our pop song.
Okay.
It's the most poppy thing we've ever done.
It has fewer bloody murder vocals than some of the other ones. Okay, good.
Cool.
Whoa. So I'm standing there and I know what it takes to make a show. 'Cause who wants to be ignored? Who wants to be alone?
6, 7, 8, 9, nowhere to run, running.
Never beat me, please believe me. There's a river running through me. I don't need no reason. I'm a changing season. Out of the rain, change. Drag myself up to bring you down. And you said, too much tragedy in this world now. Cannot help but be impressed by your logic and your state of interest.
2, 3, 4, 5, you know it's good, you better look alive. 6, 7, 8, 9, nowhere to run, so hey, hey!
Never beat me, please believe me. There's a river running through me. I don't need no reason. I'm a changing season. Out of the rain, change. You got love on back as love. You got love on back as love. The river's too much to love. Jump out the current love. Never beat me. Please believe me. There's a river running through me. I don't need no reason. I'm a changing season. Out of the rain, change. Never beat me. Please leave me. There's a river running through me. I don't need no reason. I'm a changing season. Out of the rain, change.
Sons, I could definitely hear the average white band in there, the influence coming in. That's Sons and Daughters. They're here in New York to play at the CMJ Music Festival this week. You guys have toured the U.S., and I guess I'm wondering, you know, you obviously grew up in Scotland. How does it change your impression of America when you wake up at a Motel 6 in Eugene, Oregon or something?
It's not as glamorous as I think maybe we thought it was going to be. Like, it's going to be just like Wild at Heart. You think you're going to
Let me just translate. That would be Wild at Heart.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
Wild at Heart.
It can be just like Wild
at
Heart.
It can be. I mean, driving through the desert. Yeah.
Yeah.
When you stay in some crazy hotels that look like Silent Hill, the video game. Yeah. We've had some moments like that.
How is it different when you play something like a CMJ or a South by Southwest versus your normal touring schedule? I mean, is the audience tougher? Or are they a little more welcoming? Do you plan your sets differently?
No, we just play what we do normally, don't we?
Yeah. I mean, South by Southwest certainly was a big surprise for us because we didn't even... I don't think the record... Was the record out even? I think it just come out. But we were surprised by the reaction. The reaction's been really good for both CMJ and South by Southwest. So I guess it's been quite similar to just playing our own show, really.
As long as the crowds are really drunk, it's cool.
What's the toughest crowd you guys have ever played for?
Probably the Morrissey crowd.
Oh, really?
Some of them were really tough. I mean, it's not because they didn't like it. It's just because they just want to see Morrissey.
Yeah,
you know,
and it was mostly seated venues. So you come on and there'd be people with their hands in their head in their hands, like just staring at you for the whole show.
And they had been listening to Morrissey all the way on the way to the show, getting super depressed.
Yeah.
Getting properly
getting
depressed.
Getting their full mope on.
Yeah. Well, I want to make sure we let everybody know where they can see Sons and Daughters. You guys are obviously in New York this week. You're playing tonight at the Bowery Ballroom in Manhattan. You've got gigs coming up all over the UK.
And the video Guilt on YouTube is pretty great.
Yeah, we'll link to it from our blog. This Gift is the big record coming out January 2008, but you've also got a 7-inch Guilt Complex coming out October 29th, I understand. Could you guys, I didn't really run this by the studio, but could you guys just play a little something instrumental and maybe as we go out, just something kind of, I don't know, whatever you guys do to sort of warm up. You got the capo getting ready there, so that's a good sign.
I don't know.
Just a little talking music while we read the credits to the show.
That's a lot of monotone, that one.
All right, that's good. Just keep going with that.
Sons and Daughters?
Yeah, okay. Yeah,
all right, this is Sons and Daughters from Scotland. You've been listening to the BPP.
Thanks so much for coming in. Hey, really appreciate it. Okay.
And thank you, dear listeners, for listening to this edition of the Bryant Park Project. Rachel Martin is our newscaster.
Our staff includes MJ Davis, Ilya Maritz, Dan Pashman, Wynn Rosenfeld, and Carrie Toby.
Trish McKinney is our editor. Laura Conaway is our online editor. Our senior producer is Matt Martinez. You guys are supposed to be playing under the credits.
Okay, right.
That's how I get motivated. You got to get me pumped up. There you go.
Woo!
Okay, maybe that's a little too pumped up. Do about half of that. Sharon Hoffman is our executive producer. I'm Luke Burbank.
And I'm Allison Stewart. Come visit our blog at npr.org/Bryant Park. This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. Sons and Daughters, playing us out.
Take us out, boys and girls.
Still going?